Good morning, everybody. We're back. We took a little hiatus and have both been traveling quite a bit and kids getting out of school. Jen has kids that are coming and going. And so we've just been busy. So took a little break, but we're back. And today we're going to talk about another Diary of a CEO podcast. This one is about, it's called the Feminism Debate. And haven't listened to the whole thing, the first hour and a half. It's a 2.5 hour podcast, but it was quite interesting. I was listening to it with my husband when we were driving to Colorado last night and, you know, getting his perspective on it. We were both pretty much on the same page with it, but I'm definitely interested to chat with you, Jen, about what you thought about it and, you know, talking points for you.
I didn't get a chance to listen to it.
Oh, you piece of shit.
I forgot to tell you that. I didn't get a chance to listen to it. I've been moving.
That's funny as hell.
Oh.
Okay, so we're going to pivot.
But you know what? Why don't we talk about it? And then I can, like, whatever you talk about, I can jump in and we can talk about what you've learned. Okay. And yeah.
No problem. So it's interesting. There was 3 women as guests on the podcast. One of them was a social worker, psychoanalyst. I definitely had quite a few disagreements with what she was saying. Another one, the first one is Erica Comason was her name. Another one was an author, Deborah Frances White. And she was a woman that, you know, basically grew up in a cult and then left a cult. And, the topic of feminism debate is what the sexual revolution, did to women. And, so they had a lot of contrasting perspectives. The last woman was a journalist who ended up just doing a lot of, sounds like a lot of writing on feminism just because the way her career has gone. And so originally part of the discussion was on women regretting their hookups, and the psychoanalyst talked about, you know, how women regret hookups in their life. And the other woman, Deborah, the one that was raised in a cult, she pointed out the difference between, you know, girls that are going off to college, their first experience away from home, and a lot of them, their first sexual experiences, and really kind of advocated for not all women are the same. And you can't talk about regret over their sexual interactions the same when you're, you know, 19 years old versus when you're 32.
And, oh, I agree with that. I mean, our prefrontal cortex doesn't start developing until we're 25. Yeah. So the decisions we make before that are based on, you know, not full brain development. So how can you regret something at 30 that you didn't know any better at 19?
Yeah. Well, and those early years of development from puberty to 25, this is when your social brain is developing. And this psychoanalyst was talking about how important it is that that they be protected from things like that. And it was almost like she was ignorant to the fact that this is when social learning is happening. This yes. Prefrontal cortex is our social brain. We're learning how to navigate ourselves in the same place with another person. So we don't get to 32 and not have regret about it, you know, and end up not having regret about sexual interactions if we don't have that experience where we learn how to do it and design who we are.
Exactly. Well, and also you have to look at developmental phases, right? The ages between 12 and 21 are our place to figure out who we are, develop a sense of identity. If you look at Erikson's psychosocial developmental stages, you know, it's super important to be able to figure out a sense of identity. What do we do when we're trying to figure out a sense of identity? We're playing with our sexuality. We're playing with our hair. We're playing with our, you know, trying to figure out where we fit in, how we fit in, why we want to fit in.
Yeah.
You know, so there's so many different things at play.
Absolutely. So I didn't really like her perspective. However, I liked the way Debra really kind of challenged her. And she did start to backpedal quite a bit and say, yes, there is a difference between the two. And yes, we have to educate them. But I think my biggest problem with the way she spoke was my experience, my practice, my children. Well, your experience is not statistically sound information. It's your experience. And there's 8 billion people on the planet. They're different.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's, you know, it's like confirmation bias.
Just, right. Well, you have to look at like, yeah, how much was her like her confirmation bias based on religious bias, cultural bias? You know, where did she grow up? You know, what was her parents? You know, her messages that she received came from her own parents, and who knows what they went through growing up?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what I wrote in my notes is there was no conversation about conditioning.
Exactly.
You know, the way that we're raised, 3-year-olds have the most neurons that they'll ever have in their lives. And that's why 3-year-olds are like little sponges. Mm-hmm. And she said, we all are children. And I was like, no, your brain was wired when you were a child. And that neural network, those neural networks still exist there. But those neural networks can be rewired. We're not children. We do learn how to function as adults, and we do evolve. There was no discussion about the evolution of, you know, I learned how to do addition when I was 5, but I evolved into subtraction and multiplication and division. There was a process that moved me towards getting a doctorate, right?
Right.
There's no accounting for the evolution of an individual. It was just
We're also looking at generational patterns of parenting, right? Like what kind of messages did she receive from her own parents? What kind of messages did she receive from those around her? Yeah. You know, not only we have generational patterns of trauma, we have generational patterns of parenting. We have generational patterns of societal expectations of a woman, of a man.
Yeah.
You know, well, and that's...
And Lonnie and I were definitely talking about, it sounds like she's pushing a religious agenda.
Oh.
As she was speaking. And she didn't, you know, in the first part that we listened to, we didn't hear anything about religion. But all 3 of them were still using non-feminist terms like losing your virginity. Like, No, you don't lose your virginity. She used a term... she said, you're giving your body over.
Oh,
no.
Wow. No. It's like saying that you don't have a choice, right? Like, oh, yes. I'm going to give it over. This is something. Well, and you have to look at, I mean, how much has that evolved too from the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, all the way to today?
Exactly.
You know,
yeah.
We're a lot more sexually open nowadays, but also you have to look at women nowadays aren't wanting to have sex like they used to. They're being a little bit more picky.
Yeah. But they're also more comfortable having a hookup and not connecting. You know, there's been a couple other podcasts that I've listened to and different research that I've read about how men are feeling stifled. I think we were talking about that in our last podcast about Diary of a CEO, about dating and men and how, you know, men are often frozen. They're the Me Too movement cause them to be afraid of women. And yes. Why wouldn't they?
Right.
If you can come back 20 years later and say somebody raped you, then yeah, I can see why a lot of men are like, I'm going to step back. But
well, and the last one we talked about, they had talked about too, like, politics have made it so men don't know how to be men anymore, right? But yeah. Like, if you look at the Democrats, they have made men don't know where they stand as a man, the Democrats, and the Republicans have made men almost toxic. So yeah. Men don't know how to be men anymore. And there is that fear of repercussions of what's going to happen. There is that fear of, oh shit, what am I going to do? I don't know. I like this person, but I don't want to step on their feet. I don't want to offend them. I don't want to, like, you know, get accused of anything.
Yeah.
It's a weird time to be a man.
Yeah. Well, I think it's everybody learning how to exist in our current culture. Most people are like, what the fuck is happening? And
right.
You know, everybody's trying to learn how to exist in that new world.
Yes.
So I don't think it's just men either.
Yeah. But I think too, with the slut shaming, right? I hate, you know, slut shaming, you know, that was such a term in my time, you know, the walk of shame, slut shaming, all those things, you know, the men could go out and have sex whoever they wanted to in college. And, you know, the fraternity boys were like, oh man, yeah. But the minute the girl would walk out, the walk of shame going through passing the boys and walking home and people making comments. And I think nowadays the women have a little bit more freedom. Young ladies have a lot more freedom than we did when we were going through that phase.
Yeah. But then you look at marriages. In marriage culture, the way that society talks about men is they shame them for wanting, women shame them for wanting sex, and women get shamed for not wanting it.
Yes.
And
yep.
Instead of understanding the biology behind it, is men have a higher testosterone level than women on average, mm-hmm. and it does drive more sexual interactions. And we pathologize it.
Yes.
You know, if a buck is out in a field mounting every doe, we don't look at him and say, what a fucking animal. But if a man wants to mount every woman, we're like, what a fucking animal. He's such a piece of shit. Instead of, okay, he's got biology.
Right.
He's got testosterone. Women's testosterone level is a tenth of what a man's is at their highest level.
But I don't know if you've been paying attention, but like on Facebook and like social media, they have this new, I don't want to say new, but they have like the Are We Dating the Same Guy Facebook pages. And, you know, you read these and it's all about what a dog the man is, right? What a slut he is. And yeah. And it's just like, you know, trying to explain to the women, he told you exactly what he wanted. Why as women are we not listening? Why do we think that, you know, we are special and that we're going to change somebody who has told us and shown us they're not wanting to settle down.
Yeah. And that goes right back to how we're conditioned as kids. Culture that says you're supposed to be monogamous when there are other ways to have a relationship. There's ethically non-monogamous. There's polyamorous. There's polygamous.
Yes.
There's all kinds of different relationships and relationships that can work.
Yep. And biologically, we're designed to perpetuate the species, right? Yes. So men, you know, by design are like, you know, supposed to go out there and spread their seed. So we have children for generations to come up. And, you know, they're doing all these studies on what happens when the population starts to like dwindle, you know, and they're actually, they look at how long will it take for society to decline once there's like a population, like when it cuts off and people stop having kids and there's a decline in babies. Yeah. And I think the research was like 50 to 60 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
from social psychology, the definition of survival of a species is when your children survive to reproduce.
Exactly. Yep.
So yes, absolutely. And humans have a biological drive. There's the theory of misattribution of arousal theory.
Yes.
That is, for people that don't understand, they've done lots of research that shows the way that we appraise our environment, the meanings that we attach to our environment aren't necessarily the things that are actually causing us to be aroused by something. For instance, one of the books I was just reading, he was an interviewer for terrorists, and he would take blood samples. And he was on his way to do these blood samples on a terrorist that he was interviewing. So he had dry ice with him in the car. Well, he's driving in the car on the way to this interview, and all of a sudden, you know, he starts feeling his heart rate increase, and he's like, "Oh, I'm just excited because I love my job." Well, a few minutes later, he started feeling sick. He's like, "I need to stop." So he got out, started walking around the car. Well, he got some oxygen back. What was happening was the dry ice was sucking the air out of the car, the oxygen out of the car. And he had misattributed that it was his excitement rather than, no, your heart rate increased because your oxygen level was being depleted.
Wow.
There's another one where they tested, I think it was like 450 men. And what they did is they would have this, I think it was a medical assistant, come in, and they would talk to these men. And then this medical assistant would come in, and then they would ask them to gauge their attraction to her. And they would be like, "Oh, she's a four or five." Well, in another study, they had the same person, after these men had crossed this hanging bridge, you know, so they're all these men, their adrenaline is all high.
Oh, yes.
They get to the other side, and then they ask them about their attraction to her. And they're like, "Oh, she's like a nine." And It was because their chemicals in their body had changed. They weren't measuring those chemicals. They were just interacting with their environment socially. And they attributed their attraction to her differently.
Right. So, I mean, social psychology shows us, right, if you want to like get someone attracted to you, to go to a theme park and ride a roller coaster, because The endorphins and all that makes you feel more attracted to people because you just, it wires your brain differently.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So there's so much about human biology that we ignore because we have these highly developed cortexes that attach meaning and reason and belief. And we talk about it like these women were talking about this feminist debate, and it's all meaning and reason and belief. Doesn't mean it's accurate to the biology of males and females.
Right.
And until that is considered, including the conditioning that results in those responses in their bodies, it's not going to be accurate information. It's just opinions.
Right.
Their opinion.
Yeah. Men biologically can go out and they can get as many people pregnant as they can. Right. Whereas Women, we can only carry one baby. Well, we can carry multiple babies, but we can only get pregnant once in a 9-month period.
Right.
Yeah. So you're looking at the biological perspective of that attraction, right? We have been designed to, you know, make sure that we take care of that baby once that baby is born, whereas men have been programmed to go out and spread their seed. So, you know, we want the same things, but our biologically we're programmed very differently to achieve those things.
Yeah. Absolutely. So if men are going to populate the earth, why wouldn't they do exactly what they're doing? Want to mount every doe.
Right, but exactly.
We also have highly developed cortexes, and we have social relationships, and we accept influence from other people in our social circles. So we do have a largely monogamous society.
So yes.
It does perpetuate, you know, you only get one. But that's not the only way to think about it.
Exactly.
I really had a problem with the way patriarchy was perpetuated in this feminism debate.
Yeah.
Right?
Was it portrayed like toxic? Like the patriarch is toxic? Because, you know, the patriarch has gotten such a bad reputation.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And, you know, and nowadays we portray it as something that is evil, something that wants to like go out and like steal power from other people.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are certain forms of patriarchy that are like that. But in general, I don't think people are designed with bad intentions.
I agree. Most people are genuinely good. And I believe that a lot of the ways that our current culture is, our, you know, is largely because men have been forgotten as valued members of society. Meaning, you know, there's this whole debate, what was it, last year? Would you leave your child with a man or a bear? How many men have hurt you? Most men don't.
Right.
So we have a couple men hurt us and we generalize that all men are bad and they're not. You know,
right.
Way more good men have been in my life than bad men.
Yes. Yes.
And
well, and think about how much there, you know, unspoken expectations and, you know, non-communication really affects how you're in a relationship with somebody. If you're going in automatically assuming that this person, you know, you're dating for like marriage and you're assuming everyone you date is going to be marriage material, you're going to be very disappointed.
Absolutely.
You know, and I'm a big, you know, I tell all the young ladies I work with, I'm like, date to have fun, date to see if someone's a good fit. Don't date to get married because you're going to overlook things. You're going to miss the red flags. And I'm telling you, everybody has red flags, not just men.
Yeah. And I have a lot of spices and seasonings in my cabinet. They don't all make a good fucking recipe.
Right.
So just because you get together doesn't mean, you know, that's a good person and that's a bad person. It means it depends on what ingredients you bring to the recipe, whether you're going to make a good cake or not. If that person's full of pepper, it's probably not going to be great in your cake. It doesn't mean pepper's bad. I mean, pepper might need to come over here to a salad dressing recipe. It's just
exactly
different.
Exactly. Speaking of which, the other day I was driving down the street and I saw this restaurant. It said turmeric and I thought it said Italian restaurant. And I'm like, that's interesting. A turmeric Italian restaurant. And I got closer and it was an Indian restaurant. And I'm like, that makes more sense.
But was it called turmeric?
It was called turmeric. Yeah. But I couldn't see from far away. Mm-hmm. So I thought it said Italian. I'm like, since when do turmeric and Italian go together?
Right.
But it's the same kind of concept, right?
Yeah.
You got to know what's a good mix. You got to know what you're baking with. And you got to know what you bring to the table too, because if you're pepper yourself, you're not going to make a good cake.
Absolutely. And a relationship is designed by the two people that are in it.
Yes.
Not what society says it's supposed to be, not what your parents told you, because if you base your relationship off of what your parents did, you're probably going to be disappointed because it takes two people to bring all of the same variables together.
Yeah.
To be successful. And that's never going to happen.
Well, and think about most of our parents, right? They got married really young. Mm-hmm. You know, they really, and a lot of them did know each other because it really wasn't a big world back in the day.
Right.
Everybody just kind of married each other that was from
a
small city.
Internet. Yeah.
Yeah. So you knew each other for a long time. You grew up together. And nowadays we're meeting people on the internet. We're not getting a full picture of who they are. We don't know their family. We don't know their friends.
Yeah.
So we're kind of just winging it. And, you know, especially if we're coming from two different cultures, you know, we're speaking very different languages.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
From a brain perspective, you know, in our society, we perpetuate this idea of normal. And maybe I've said this before on an earlier podcast. You know, human beings have about 100 trillion synaptic connections in their brain. And the synaptic connections are the spaces between which our experiences are stored as electrochemical signals. They're transmitted across those networks. And so the average person has 100 trillion experiences stored in their brains. There's 8 billion people on the planet. The mathematical likelihood that any two people could be the same is zero.
Yes.
So when you take that into account, you understand there's a lot of ingredients in the world. And if you're going to make a recipe, you have to come together and really kind of assess, is this a good recipe for the two of us? It doesn't matter how many couples I've seen. There's never one person that's to blame for all the problems in the relationship. It's always two. You know,
right?
If a man is beating the shit out of his wife every day, society says he's the problem. But if she keeps going back, how is she not contributing to a problem?
Or if she's following him and she's instigating, setting boundaries, not protecting herself. And I'm not trying to victim blame at all. That's not what we're getting at here. Is what we're getting at is that, yes, it's always usually a we problem. There's some kind of dysfunction in the system that causes that imbalance to be able for abuse to happen.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, by the time people leave, you know, we read about women who get killed or men who get killed by their spouse. And it's not just they just met and they got killed, right? Usually there's a long established pattern of things that have happened throughout that relationship where it got to the point where it got violent.
Where
it got deadly.
Absolutely. And there's a difference between abusers. There's characterological abusers, which are very pathological. Often have a serious mental disorder. But where did that come from? That usually came from the system that they grew up in, right?
Exactly. It was a coping skill at one point, right?
Absolutely.
It was a survival skill. Yep.
But situational abuse is different. However, in our domestic violence treatment society, they treat them both the same, and they're not the same. Situational abusers often, one in particular that comes to mind is a man that grew up in an environment where he was really bullied by the adults in his life. And, you know, he's really soft hearted and, you know, he had a lot of bullies in his life, and he got to a point with a partner, and this partner was just poke, 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 poke. And eventually he ended up with a domestic violence charge. Mm. And it's because it was situational. And, you know, everybody has fight, flight, freeze. He'd gotten to the point where he was fleeing. You know, he had always been fleeing or freezing. And eventually he moved into fight. Yep. And now he has a domestic violence charge. Yes, I think it's appropriate that anybody that's violent towards another person should have consequences, because you know, the general rule is you don't hit anybody. It's not just a man never hits a woman. It's that a woman never hits a man either. The majority of domestic violence cases that I've seen have been more women who hit men.
Right. And I think we all have that in us, right? We all have it in it where we get backed into a corner where we're just all of a sudden now we're feeling like we're helpless, we're powerless, and we're going to do whatever it takes to get out of that situation to get our power back.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. And if you're in an abusive relationship, you know, if you are being abused, please reach out and get help. This, you know, it's a, you know, what happens is, you know, we get into this cycle of abuse, and it's so hard to get out of, because now all of a sudden your power is gone. You feel helpless. You feel like you're 8 years old and you have nowhere to go and you've been isolated. You feel alone and you feel like there's nothing, there's no way to get out of this.
Yeah.
And you feel like there's something inherently wrong with you.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So if you're in a domestic abuse relationship, please reach out and get help. There is help. Yeah. And, you know, sometimes it takes a long time to get out.
Yeah.
So give yourself some grace.
And in relationships that have that, situational toxicity, take your partner. A lot of times, you know, therapists have been conditioned not to see a couple together if there's domestic violence. And that's not necessarily the case when it's situational. If it's characterological, where, you know, this person is all about being in control all the time, you know, just to summarize characterological, yes, I would not see a characterological abuse, an abuser with his victim.
Yeah, but now we're looking at, like, you know, sociopathology, right? And psychopathology.
Yes. Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah. But in situational cases, I absolutely will, because I want each of them to understand how their behavior is a coping mechanism from previous experiences in their life. Let's build more effective coping mechanisms, and let's do it. You can do that in the same space as your partner. But you learn how to set boundaries. You learn how to recognize, you know, fight, flight, freeze in your body. And you go, okay, I'm going to go over right here and I'll come back when I'm in control of my actions, not you have to calm me down.
Well, remember for you guys out there too, is that, you know, we learn how to be in a relationship by watching our parents. And as Mary says, you know, we have the most neurological pathways in our brain than we'll ever have in the rest of our life before the age of 7. So if you're watching two parents constantly in this attack and withdrawal, and just, you know, constant, state of chaos, then what have you learned? Your central nervous system gets wired to recreate that. So we end up in trauma bonds throughout our lives, recreating that. I'm going to push you and then you're going to push back and then we're going to attack each other and then pull away and just, we're going to recreate all the chaos we ever knew in our life growing up.
Yeah. We're all normal within the context of our lives, but normal isn't always effective. The goal is to be effective, but recognize how our coping mechanisms tended to work in the past, but you get to a point when those don't work anymore because it's a new environment.
When you have to remember the difference between like surviving and thriving, right? Surviving is, you know, keeping those same coping skills that you used and recreating all the things that you've learned from your own parents. Where thriving is recognizing this is no longer working. It's causing me a lot of chaos. It's causing me a lot of angst. It's causing us to be abusive towards each other. And now it's being able to step back and say, hey, let's get rid of what we saw growing up and develop something new, a new template. Let's have a blank template and learn as we go on what's healthy and what's not.
Yeah. Learn not to be hijacked by the things you were hijacked by when you were younger, before you had more effective coping mechanisms.
And our amygdala is going to hijack us all the time. And it's going to be a constant like struggle to be able to tell that amygdala, calm the frick down, man. Well, you're not in danger. This person loves me. This person is not a threat. I can, you know, go to them and not, you know, automatically scream and assume the worst.
Yeah. And our brain doesn't distinguish between an actual threat and a perceived threat. Our body feels it from earlier experience. And we say, I'm going to generalize this. That's a threat. When actually there's not even a bear in the room. Your partner just said, can you help me with the dishes?
Right.
It's, oh shit, now I'm in trouble like I was when I was a kid and I didn't do the dishes.
Oh shit's gonna hit the fan now. Yeah. But what if you live with a polar bear in your living room your whole entire life and you've learned to walk on eggshells and walk around and tiptoe around that polar bear? That stays with you. Our central nervous system is designed to protect us and predict what's gonna happen next. And if we've always growing up had a polar bear, what we're gonna do is assume everyone's a polar bear. Yeah. And we're going to keep using those same techniques that we use in order to like get what we need. And oftentimes, you know, we can simply just go up to our partner and say, I'm feeling lonely. I need a hug. But if we've never had that model to us, what are we going to do? We're going to poke. We're going to like be, you know, instigate. We're going to do things that are going to create a lot of chaos.
Yeah. You know, that's, I think this is a good pivot to what you wanted to talk about today, the series Dying for Sex.
Yes.
Right. Because there's, there's that whole family history that you see and you see the toxicity and the chaos in their relationships and, you know, how trauma was perpetuated throughout her life.
So. One of my things that I love about that series is the fact that they really like that they show what disassociation looks like. You know, we're often saying I disassociated, but it's really hard to like pinpoint what disassociation is. And for her, she described it as a blanket, right? And then you'd see her when she was trying to get intimate, it was just a big blinding bright light and she couldn't get away from it. And she'd freak out when she was trying to be intimate. And I think, you know, that's what happens is we learn from such an early age to disassociate. We don't even know how to describe what's happening to us most times. It just happens so subconsciously.
Even the term disassociation in mental health is not necessarily defined accurately according to human beings because, yes, a symptom in the DSM in multiple places is dissociation where your brain goes, okay, I'm going to avoid that. I'm going to ignore that. And our body just escapes it. And that's a way of coping. You know, a lot of people with sexual trauma, for instance, very cool research on the brain of children that have been sexually abused, the parts of their brain that were connected to the parts of their body that were touched inappropriately, you can see a slower development. Mm. But once you treat that trauma, that development comes back very rapidly. And what the body does is the body learns, I don't have to protect my body from being touched anymore. But during that deficit, that's the word I'm thinking of, that deficit in development is a way of protecting that child from having to re-experience the same thing over and over again when you have repeated trauma, for instance.
Right.
And you treat it, that part of the brain becomes developed again, and the body is no longer dissociating from it, but it has dissociated from that experience. The figures are no longer lingering there like an attacker. So dissociation is a good thing as well. You're teaching the brain, okay, I don't need that part of my bodily response anymore to protect me.
Right. Well, and you think about how much this association affects us, you know, physically, right? There's like so much research that shows a lot of kids that are sexually abused will often, their puberty is delayed, or, you know, they become overly sexual, right? We also see that it takes over mentally, right? People that just shut down and all of a sudden they just go through the motions, they look and they act like they're there, but emotionally they're not present.
Yeah.
So we do get a lot of regression too. We skip those developmental phases that happen at the time where we are being hurt. Yeah, which physically, emotionally, and sexually.
Yeah, that's why oftentimes they'll say that person is stunted at the level at the age of their abuse. You get abused when you're 7 and then you're 50 years old behaving like a 7-year-old. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Because it does stunt development. It causes, you know, a deficit in that development. But once you process that, your body learns what to do differently. It does catch up.
Yes. One of the things I always ask my clients is, you know, I go over the generational patterns of trauma. What did your parents experience as their trauma? How old were they when they experienced it? And then I ask them, you know, what age did you outgrow your parents emotionally? And most people say elementary school, middle school, high school. And what happens, it's really hard to give to you what wasn't given to yourself as a parent. Yes. If nobody was there protecting you, if nobody was there teaching you how to protect yourself physically, emotionally, all the things, oftentimes what happens is you put your kids in the same positions because you don't know anybody and there was nobody teaching you that this wasn't right.
Yeah. Parents that yell at their kids and say, don't yell at me.
Yeah.
Well, where did they learn that?
Exactly. Yesterday, my son and I were driving. That's such a funny story, is that we're driving, we're having a conversation about something. And I said, I forgot what it was. And then I told him, I said, you know, a conversation isn't about you trying to change my mind. And he stops and he looks at me and he's like, do you not realize that you spent the last 5 minutes trying to get me to agree to what you just said? And I'm like, oh my God, you are so right. I am so sorry. But I sat there trying to tell him what he was doing wrong when I was doing the same thing.
Yeah.
And I said, I see where you get it from and I do apologize.
Yeah. Well, and that's so perpetuated in our society that there's so much responsibility that comes with parenting in our society that it's your job to guide them and drive them to become whoever you think they're supposed to be, that parents don't take the time to learn who their kid is.
Exactly.
And yes, you have to have time when this is not a parenting moment. This is just, hey, I'm getting to know my kid and I'm going to let you influence me. That's what helps a kid learn that they have value in the world.
Right? Well, and if you have never had a
suck all the time.
Right. And if you had a history of, you know, abuse, physical, emotional, sexual abuse, and you feel like you don't have a voice, a say, or an option, all of a sudden you go to raise teenagers and what happens? They talk back. They have a voice of their own. They want to be heard. They don't want to sit there and be lectured. They don't want to be mom or dad splained and everything.
Yeah.
So it's like we have to understand that, you know, kids are going, we're raising humans. We're not raising little robots.
Yeah. Well, I use this example of, you know, 7-year-old little girls, they sit around and they plan their wedding in the future. And then they get to a point in their life when they meet somebody and they're like, this is what my wedding is going to be like. And this other person is like, no, I don't want that. That's not what I want. And they plan their whole wedding without somebody else in mind. That's what
parents
do. However, parents do the same thing when they're pregnant. They start planning this child's future, but they're planning it ignoring the fact that you are giving birth to a human being
who has
interests of their own, things that they like or don't like.
And they have free will.
Yes.
Yes.
So if you plan your child's whole future without them in mind, you're going to get some rejection in return. Guaranteed. Yeah. Because everybody wants to be comfortable. Everybody wants autonomy. Everybody wants to have control over their own lives.
And going back to Erikson's psychosocial stages, right? Autonomy is one of them. And if we're sitting here and not letting our kids make choices or make mistakes, if we're helicoptering them, if we're snowplowing them, we're setting them up for like failure in the future. Yeah. We're going to have a whole generation of kids that can't problem solve.
Research shows that a lot of the kids that die in college were kids that were raised by helicopter parents, because those kids didn't get to make decisions. They go off to college and they're like, fucking finally.
Free, I'm free.
Off the fucking rails.
Because yes.
They didn't get to make mistakes. They didn't get to be guided and you know, still have support with recovering from those mistakes. So they understand there's consequences.
Yep.
Not just your parents' consequences, but life consequences.
Yep. I'm a perfect example of that. You know, I had a mom who was an alcoholic and very emotionally and physically abusive. And when I went off to college, I was free. I was like, oh damn, I am free. And I ended up drinking too much. I ended up getting kicked out of college my freshman year. I ended up almost dying because I jumped off a bridge because we were, well, not jumping off of a bridge, like literally, but like we really were. We were jumping off the bridge into the Mississippi River.
Like, are you going to jump off a bridge? And you're like, yeah, what?
And that's the thought that happened to me as I jumped off the bridge, realizing I'm not a good swimmer. And I'm jumping off the bridge into the Mississippi River after high like floodwaters. And I'm like, oh shit. I said, this is where my mom, I can hear my mom's voice in my head. If someone jumps off of a bridge, are you going to follow? And I'm like, actually, I jumped first.
Of course you did.
But I made a lot of mistakes because I was trying to get my sense of identity, autonomy, all the things that I missed out during childhood.
Yeah. I got married at 17, really to escape. You know, obviously I didn't think this at the time, or maybe I did. But yeah, I got married at 17 to escape. You know, people telling me what the fuck to do. I wanted to be on my own. And I feel like I did fairly good for myself without everybody up my ass about everything.
Yep. I took the long way to get where I was at because I had to learn for myself. I couldn't have everybody up my ass telling me what to do, how to do it, you know, to be afraid of life. That's what my mom taught me. Be afraid of life. Life is scary. People out there are scary. And you know what? I found out that they weren't. I had to find out that way. Yeah. I had to be able to learn how to trust my own gut, my own instincts, and to be able to lean into that and not just go off of like my mom's own generational patterns of trauma. Yes.
Yeah. My mom's anxiety was driven off of her mom's anxiety. And
exactly.
Absolutely. My first marriage, I was full of anxiety.
Yeah. And my mom's cousin was killed by Ted Bundy, and she was really young, maybe 18 years old. And forever, that's all I ever heard is, be careful. You can't walk alone. You can't do this. You can't do that. There's dangerous people out there. And, you know, forever she helicoptered me because she was afraid something bad was going to happen to me.
Right. Generational trauma.
Exactly. Yeah. But we have to wrap things up for the day. Yep. So thank you guys for tuning in.
Ted Bundy. And if you need help in a domestic violence relationship, reach out for help. Try not to assume ahead of time, you know, the value of the people in your relationship, and go to a professional.
And remember, you're not crazy. There's nothing wrong with you. You're not overreacting. You're not too sensitive. You have good gut. You have good instincts. Listen to it. And if you need help, please go seek professional help. You are not alone.
Absolutely. So like, subscribe, reach out, ask questions. We'd love to answer your questions on our next podcast. So we'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, we'll see you guys next week. Have a wonderful week. Go live out there. Go out there and live bravely and courageously.
That's right.
Smartly.
Life is fun.
Yes.
Bye.
Bye, guys. Have a